questions from your seat, or else to write your question down and send. Can I have the microphone here? There's someone at the back here.
We have microphones on two sides, so we'll try to take turns and kind of go back and forth.
I'd like to ask Your Holiness, and how did you change your mind and become a Buddhism and finally be a monk? What really, you know, make you change your mind?
For an English boy, I was probably unusually studious, and that was partly due to the fact that I had quite severe asthma as a child. So I was off school a lot, spent a lot of time alone, and spent a lot of that time reading. So I, by the time I reached my early teens, there was a question in my mind, is like, what's a good way to live, or what's the best way to live your life as a human being? And so I had no sense of connection at all with Christianity since I was about 7 or 8 years old. It didn't make any sense to me at all. I just felt very alien, and I didn't have any connection, and so I didn't see this as a religious quest at all at that time. So I was reading a lot of books on psychology and philosophy and so on. And then I eventually came across teachings of the Buddha, and they just made complete sense to me. And I can remember thinking, this isn't some kind of Eastern philosophy. This is just clear and obvious common sense. So I started to study Buddhism and practice meditation. And then when I finished high school, I felt a very strong pull to Asia from childhood. Never really felt at home in England. And so I made some money. I worked, made some money, and then set off overland from England to India. So it was a kind of combined an interest in India and Indian spirituality with just a desire to for experience and for adventure. So it ended up being a 2-year odyssey, 2-year trip. By the time I returned to England, I realized I didn't want to do anything with my life except learn about Buddhism and practice Buddhism. And I enrolled on a meditation course with a Vipassana meditation teacher who had been a monk in Thailand for a number of years. And in his talks, he would refer to his time as a monk. And I can remember thinking, well, that's exactly the life that I've been looking for the past 2 or 3 years. That's exactly what I should be doing. So I decided to become a monk at that point. And while I was making some money in order to buy a plane ticket to get to Thailand, then I got to know about a monastic community from Thailand who were establishing a forest monastery in England. I ended up spending a few months with that community in England. And their teacher was a great master called Ajahn Chah in northeast Thailand. And so when I left that community, I went to stay with Ajahn Chah in northeast Thailand, so that was 1978, and I've been there ever since. That's my story. How could... Yeah, I was very motivated. You can't. I mean, it's not possible to motivate someone else in that way. I mean, you can inspire by your personal example, or you can provide... inspiring examples of other people who've made similar choices, but at the end of the day, it really has to be voluntary, and living as a Buddhist monk is not easy at all. It's physically very demanding, mentally can be very stressful, certainly in the beginning, and if you don't really have that strong internal motivation, then you won't make it, really. But in terms of, you know, how to stimulate that in others, then that's, you know, it depends on where they're starting from. And usually if people become monks just out of a sense of aversion to lay life, or just sense of just can't handle this lay life and think that being a monk is a kind of an escape from that, then those are the ones who never last very long at all. And there are monks who, there are people who go to monasteries and from the first day they say they want to spend the rest of their life in the monastery. And I'm going to make a confession here that in my monastery, you know, when someone comes like this, we would have a little bet about how many days they'd last. You know, like, I give in 3 days, maybe 2 weeks, you know. So. And it's the ones who are kind of living day by day that often end up spending the longest. And
I have a question that, you know, as a human being, when we get older, our bodies seem to be degrading. But our five sense of hearing, or sight, it seems that even as we get older, with the right instrument, be able to bring back our sense, and our hearing. Does the Buddha mention anything about, like, is this sense of hearing, sighting, testing, is it be like gone when we pass away, or is it permanently of the sense itself? It seems like as we get older, it's still there. It's like, you just need the right instrument to bring it back. But that's my question. Right? Does a mental state change any of these five senses we have as we get older? That's all.
No, I mean, as you get older, it's basically all downhill. I mean, that's just the way it is. You know, modern technology can take the edge off that a bit, but I mean, it's no, it just gets worse and worse, and then you die. No, but the mind does not disappear at death. So the mind, but you see, you have to understand that the mind is not a thing. You know, so I like to say the mind's not a noun; it's a verb. You have to understand your whole life as a verb. You know, it's like hearing and seeing and smelling and the body and the mind. These are all verbs. These are all expressions of change. And with the end of the physical body, then the mental body survives and looks for an appropriate expression for it, physical expression for it. One of the best analogies for this is of a candle flame. So, you know, if you analyze what exactly is a candle flame, you know, it seems like a thing, you know, you say it's a flame, but actually it's a process, isn't it? And that process, which we refer to as a flame, as the candle, the physical basis for it, comes to an end, then we can light a second candle from the first candle. But it's not that the first flame has been reborn in the second candle. It's just a continuity of the flame, because the causes and conditions for its survival are intact. Excuse me. But yeah, don't worry about ears and stuff like that. Are they? Pardon? What is? Yes, it's all impermanent. But you see there, you know, the impermanence, as I say, it's a verb, it's a conditioned flow of phenomena. So each particular aspect or element of the flow is impermanent, but we overall the sort of consistency of change can give the appearance of a thing or of a being even.
Just a quick reminder, for the first, there's also a Q&A session in the afternoon, but if you can please just keep it to one question for now so we can try to get it to as much people as we can and we'll go back and forth on each side.
Hi. I know you spoke of cultivation and that meditation is one form of it. Are there any other forms of cultivation that we can practice on a day-to-day life?
Yeah, there are the four main areas of cultivation which the Buddha taught. Firstly, cultivation of the relationship of the human being and the physical environment. And secondly is the relationship of the human being and the social environment. And the third is the cultivation of the heart. And the fourth is cultivation of wisdom. So the cultivation of the relationship to material world, then that begins with that aspect of the material world which you take direct responsibility for, meaning your body. Concerns being wise in the amount and the kind of food that you put in your body, taking enough and timely rest, get exercise. So in this way of thinking, being wise about, you know, eating and resting and taking exercise is overall picture is every bit as important as meditating every day. Because if you don't take care of these kind of basics, then you don't have the foundation to really apply these more profound techniques. Excuse me. The second of this material development concerns our relationship to our possessions, to money, to our house, our car, technology. So many people these days have a rather dysfunctional relationship to technologies and to telephones and social media and all these things. And it's very important to work that out and to have a healthy relationship with all these things. Otherwise, again, it's going to undermine spiritual practices such as meditation. Third, sort of outer shell of this is wise relationship to the physical environment in which we live, and we know we're within a space of a couple of hundred years since the Industrial Revolution, where we've been living in such a way that it's unlikely that we're even going to have a world to live in within the next 100, 200 years. As the effects of global climate change intensify and we receive the fruits of the karma that we've been creating over the next past 200 years, this is going to become more and more of an issue for everyone. So as I was saying, like, Buddhism, sometimes it's like, it's just all about meditation and sitting with your eyes closed, but it's like everything, it's your whole life. So that's just what, like, particular areas. So it was mentioned earlier on that I'm interested in education, and the schools that I work with use these four kinds of cultivation as the basic framework for the education of the children. Yes, this gentleman over here. Oh, okay. He's got the microphone. Go ahead.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My question has to do with the four stages of enlightenment, and in particular with stream entry. And in my case, I am a layman with just a few short years of study and not overly disciplined study. So I'd like to know about stream entry in particular, and the possibilities for a lay person to gain stream entry in this lifetime. That's the crux of my question.
Yes, well, there have been laymen, laywomen, householders who have realized stream entry throughout Buddhist history, from the time of the Buddha until the present day. And I think that stream entry is probably the wisest and most legitimate spiritual goal for a lay Buddhist practitioner. So I would say, in terms of the potential for stream entry, yes, it's definitely there. But of course, the distinction between monastic lifestyle and lay lifestyle is not so clear cut as it was in the time of the Buddha. And for all of the advantages and disadvantages of capitalist system, one is that it does give many people, at least those who are free from basic pressures to survive physically, it gives you choices of lifestyle that people have never had in the past. So it's quite feasible as a lay Buddhist in the present world to decide perhaps to take a cut in income in order to find a livelihood and a way of living in the world which is conducive to spiritual goals and which is not too busy and disturbing, as something in which the qualities of simplicity and application of mindfulness in daily life is possible. So I would say, as a layman, it is possible, but it is certainly dependent on your particular living conditions and finding a way of living and making your living in such a way that it's not too disturbing for your mind, and in which you have periods of quiet reflection, and that the five precepts are absolute necessity, and to be finding regular periods of time when you can go off on retreat and devote yourself to meditation practices in a more kind of focused, intense way, to alternate with the normal practice in daily life. So if you have a simple lifestyle, good moral foundation, good friendships, and giving sufficient time for study and for meditation, then living as a lay person is sufficient foundation for stream entry. You don't have to. You just keep going. It's best not to be too concerned with that. That, in fact, probably one of the chief features of Buddhist communities over the past 2,500 years is overestimation of attainments, and so my teacher would really downplay this whole thing, because once you get into this, I want to gain this level and that level, it can bring up some very unwholesome mental states and actually be an obstruction to it. But as if you find that you're making significant advances in your meditation period, your meditation practice, then every now and again it's good to go and see experienced meditation masters and just to check that everything's going well and you're on the right path. So in a meditation tradition, like in Northeast Thailand, then we have certain enlightened monks who provide this service to younger monks, the younger monks who've had strong experiences and believe that they've attained or realized some particular stage, would go and ask these monks to look at their minds and to check them out, basically. But that kind of service is not so easily found in lay life.
Your Holiness, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask you if my practice is correct. I'm able to meditate. Hello? I'm able to meditate twice a day. I'm able to find mindfulness throughout the day. And I wanted to go further, and Vipassana meditation indicates that you want to watch your body and your mind. And when you find phenomena, I'm able to find phenomena when it starts, when it ends. And sometimes when the mind wants to grasp to it or attach to it. And the concept of it is to watch it from the self. But at what point do I know that it's not the mind playing games with me, trying to tell me that it's the self who's watching and not the mind?
Yeah, I wouldn't overthink this. You know, it's just keep observing what's going on, and bringing to the mind certain reminders. excuse me. One of the key teachings of my teacher is reminding of it's not sure, or maybe not, just to see the uncertain, changing, shifting nature of things. And so this become part of your whole life and the way of responding and attending to phenomena, is to see their unstable and changing nature. So there is a certain role for this more discursive or cerebral kind of approach, which doesn't detract from, but it provides a step towards the direct insight into the way things are. But the most important thing to develop is strong samadhi, because when the mind is very fully stable, like there's an unshakable kind of stability and clarity and brightness to the mind, then that mind will be ready to clearly see the arising and passing away of phenomena as it truly is, without any question of kidding yourself or assuming things. So it's the power of the mind which needs to be built up through the meditation practice. So one of the key features of the well-developed mind is a quality called kamaniyo, which means ready to work or pliable, or is this readiness to see the impermanence, dukkha, the selflessness of phenomena. So the mind has to be taken to that point of readiness where this seeing just takes place as a natural outcome of that maturity of mind. Does that answer your question? Yes, you do. Thank you. Yeah.
Ajahn, I have a question that I guess deals with right livelihood, but I also feel it also deals with promotion of the Dhamma. So I'm wondering, for example, if you're a business person and you have a service that you feel is very strongly is able to help people, and you want to be able to promote it in a way, but you also don't want to, I guess, force people to accept things that they don't need. And in the same way, I'm asking, I guess, in kind of leading people to the Dhamma, whether from your experience there's a way to kind of show people the value of the Dhamma without, I guess, coming across as like a salesman or something like that. Just, you know, provide people value but not kind of force them to kind of do something that might not be in their best interest at the time.
Well, yeah, I mean, from point of view of a Buddhist monk, like the whole kind of Theravada approach is basically, here it is, take it or leave it. You know, it's there. So like no compromises, to make it more popular, and palatable, to people. You know, it's like saying, yeah, this not self-teaching, it doesn't go down so well these days. Maybe we cut that bit out, you know. Well, we can't do that. And Buddhist monks are actually forbidden from teaching anyone who doesn't express a particular desire, interest to listen. So, you know, this is formalized in this kind of beautiful invitation to give a talk that we heard this morning, but it means that Buddhist monks can't be evangelical in any way. You can't just sort of knock on somebody's door and say, look, I've come from Thailand to tell you the good news about Buddhism. But this is, for me, and I think for many people, it's one of the attractive qualities of Buddhism, that it's not trying to sell itself and saying, if you're genuinely interested, I'll share everything that I know without any wish for any kind of reward. So that's the kind of traditional Theravadin approach. Of course, if you're trying to develop something in the business world, then that's a different environment and sort of different expectations. And but I think that general spirit of you know, wanting to share for people who have a genuine interest should always take precedence over this idea of trying to persuade people or trying to, certainly we don't want to convert anybody. I was saying yesterday, one of my favorite sayings to the Dalai Lama is, I don't want to convert any of you to become Buddhist. I want you to be better what you are already. So, you know, enabling people who, you know, already have some kind of affiliation or some kind of commitments, maybe that there is something in the Buddhist tradition that they can make use of, and and enrich their life within the tradition in which they, you know, they are happy to live. So we're not looking for like quantity of people or followers, but more quality is more important. But I think in anything, you know, that sense of the first of all the initial impulse must come from the person itself. You know, in the talk I was talking about the precepts and training of body and speech. But, you know, and this is another point that if somebody, you know, doesn't kill, doesn't harm, doesn't steal, doesn't commit adultery and all these things, but refrains from those things because he's afraid of going to prison or afraid of social ostracism or afraid of some kind of punishment, then it wouldn't be considered to be a virtuous person. He's someone who has sila in the Buddhist sense, because it's only sila when it's within the context of this overall training for enlightenment. And that sila only fulfills that function which supports, nourishes practice of meditation, development of wisdom, when it's voluntary. So I think in short, in most cases, it's being a really good example is probably the best way of encouraging other people. You know, if you're practicing Buddhism, and people notice that you're very happy and kind and honest and trustworthy and so on, then that is something that, Buddhism must be something to that. But I'm not in the world, as it say, then setting up businesses and things which are based upon Buddhist principles or wishing to promote Buddhist principles and expecting payment for it. I don't think that's unethical in itself. I'm just sort of giving you a bigger picture of kind of Buddhist attitude to the spreading of Dhamma. Yeah.
Question over here. I'd like to ask, do you practice any form of fasting? And if you have any thoughts on if it has any correlation or how does it come into play with the cultivation that you were speaking of earlier?
Well, generally, Buddhist monks, we only eat one meal a day, so we fast 24 hours as that's our life, you know, 24-hour fasting. As far as longer fasting is concerned, it was never recommended by the Buddha. It's not included in one of the ascetic practices which the Buddha recommended for his disciples. But at the same time, he didn't forbid it. I mean, fasting was a kind of a really big deal in India at the time of the Buddha. And before he became enlightened, he did incredible fasts. But he concluded at the end of some of these really extreme fasts that there was no causal link between fasting and enlightenment. In monasteries, I've lived in monasteries most of my life, and you get young men in their 20s, and you've got this kind of, warrior kind of, everybody wants to sort of push a little bit, do things a little bit kind of tough and challenging, and after you've sort of got the basics of monastic life down, then often monks want to do things like this, and I myself, as a young monk, did. But I think it's more a matter of being very, very observant of the effects it has. I mean, just as a trial and just to see what it's like, it's quite a good thing to do. And, for instance, exposes if you have a lot of concerns and fears about food and going hungry, I mean, if you fasted regularly, you know, there's one day when you miss an evening meal or you don't get home in time for an evening meal, you don't get upset about it. You know, it's not a big deal. But I would say that the effects of fasting depend a lot on the character of the person. If someone's very, very speedy, or they have a lot of sensual desire, fasting can be quite a good way to calm the mind down. But if the mind, if you're already kind of easygoing and you don't have that very strong, passionate personality, then sometimes fasting just, rather than calming the mind down, it agitates the mind. So it's a little bit dependent on the person. And of course, what kind of fast you do. I mean, when I was, you know, as a young monk, you know, it was a fasting meant just plain water fast for 7 days or something like that, or done drinking urine for 7 days, things like that. But these days you have all these kinds of different fruit juices and stuff, so kind of like a different kind of thing. And,
Tanachan, I have a question regarding how do you bhavana in action? And the background to that is I was listening to Ajahn Chah's recording, and I think there was a merchant lady that asked him, like, asking Ajahn Chah that she didn't have time, you know, to bhavana. And then Ajahn Chah's response to that was, you know, do you have time to breathe?
Yeah.
And of course she says yes. And then his follow-up answer was, I didn't meant for you to sit there in the middle of the market and close your eyes and meditate. But I don't fully understand what Ajahn Chah meant by that, by, you know, how do you bhavana basically throughout the whole day and then in action? Thank you.
Well, I'm going to give an answer. It's maybe not necessarily expanding upon Ajahn Chah's answer. So my answer, okay, is I think that chunking is a very good policy. Because people know what chunking is. It's not a city in China. It's a kind of way of just dividing big things up into smaller things. So you're probably familiar with it. So let's say, like, your day, and chunking your day is cutting it up into chunks. So from when you get up in the morning until when you leave the house to go to work, might be your first chunk, like the trip to work, driving to work, a second chunk, morning, a third chunk, midday, afternoon, evening, nighttime. And then having specific goals, pavana goals for those different periods of time, and relating that to what I refer to as the four right efforts. So, for instance, let's say you drive to work every day, maybe it's an hour in the traffic. And so how do you pavana? Well, you might say, ask yourself, what are the unwholesome dhammas that are likely to arise while or have arisen in the past when I drive to work? And it might be, I get really irritated with people who drive in a selfish manner, or I get angry with this or fed up with that. So then your practice, your Dhamma practice, is drive to work, you know, at the right time and safely, but at the same time, without being irritated by the things that usually irritate you. Or another example of going into a meeting. Obviously, you know, you can't sit in, if you sit in a meeting and watch your breath, then, you know, you're not going to get very far in your career. Maybe unless you're the CEO, and then you're just considered kind of special kind of person. Again, you know, you say, well, what are the kind of things that can come up in a meeting? Yeah, again, the sort of irritation of somebody, speaks too long or speaks off the topic, or I find that when I listen, I tune out when I'm listening to people and just go start daydreaming, or else I give far more attention to the arguments of people I like than to the people I don't like. Or when I have to speak myself, I become very self-conscious and overly worried about whether people like me or not. These are all kinds of unwholesome dhammas, normal everyday things that can come up in that kind of situation. So that's your dhamma practice. How can I prevent those things from arising in my mind? And if they do arise, how will I deal with them? And then similarly, what are the wholesome kind of dhammas that I can develop? Well, patience is obviously a good one. Listening skills, communication skills. So if we're not just thinking of meditation as just the sort of application of a technique in order to calm the mind, and you know, but this being awake and aware and cultivating right action, right speech, listening skills, communication skills, patience, kindness, all these kinds of things, then we can find in every situation there's actually a practice that you can do. If you expand the idea of what practice might be from, you know, some application of one specific technique, and see how much richer it is than that, then you can even start to be quite creative with that. You know, not letting your mind wander off here and there, being mindful, being the present. You know, if you're by yourself, in the bathroom, whether you're showering or brushing your teeth, or getting dressed, then you can put more emphasis into physical movement. When you're walking from a building to a car, climbing up steps or down steps, standing in an elevator, then don't let those short periods of time just fritter away, but use them to reestablish your mindfulness. Because I think that for most people, when you feel at the end of the day, you know, you're really kind of finished, you know, you're tired and weary and stressed out, that I think that it's rare that there are really major stressful incidents during the day, every now and again perhaps. But it's more like a slow, steady drip, drip, drip of stressful, small stressful incidents. And that by stopping and reestablishing attention, just by sitting in front of your computer and watching your breath for 60 seconds, converting a walk from one building to another building, or upstairs or downstairs into a walking meditation practice, you can just cut off that accumulation of stress and then reestablish that clarity and freshness of mind. So there are so many different ways of cultivating in daily life. Anything else? Somebody else? Yeah. What is one? That one. Yeah, I don't know. I had to think about that because I get asked so many questions by so many people, and some of them are very repetitive. Some I've answered thousands of times. Others are more unusual, and like every Wednesday I go to school and I have a whole bunch of children asking me questions. So that's a whole, some of those are very unusual, and Interesting. I don't have a good answer for you really, but I would say that, you know, a common theme in Thailand, you know, people often say, "I'm very angry. How can I deal with my anger? How can I let go of anger?" And yet there are very few people who say, "I'm very greedy. How can I let go of my greed?" So I always think there's very few people really see the danger and the suffering inherent in greed in the way that they do in anger. So I'd maybe like more people to ask questions about that. Yeah.
Just letting you all know that we're going to have one more question for now, and then we're going to take a break, I believe, after this.
English now. As far as I study the Buddhism, there are two factors, internal and external. The internal, yoniso manasikan, external is kalyanamit. If they don't have kalyanamit here in this country as much as we have in Thailand, how do they go about progressing in practicing Buddhism? And how much weight do you put on the pariyat versus patibat when you try to get into the right path? Thank you.
Okay, I'll repeat that for those of you who didn't hear clearly. On one occasion, the Buddha spoke about the main, the most important conditioning factors for the development or rising of the Eightfold Path. So one external factor and one internal factor. So the external factor is the voice of another, Paratakosa, but which is generally explained as good friendship, good spiritual friendship. And the internal factor is what we call yoniso manisikara, or wise reflection. So what the Buddha is saying is you need to have an environment in which you are, you have good friends, good influences, things that lift you up and encourage you and support you on your spirit, in your spiritual practice. But at the same time, you need this reflective quality, the ability to observe and to learn from experience and to reflect upon experience. That's what we call yoniso manasikara. And so the question was that living here, maybe there's a lack of kalyanamitta. I'm not sure about that. I don't live here, but in one sense I would say that we're living in a blessed time. Just now I mentioned a little about global warming and the environmental degradation, which is going to get, I believe, even worse and worse in the future. But at the same time, never in the whole history of the world has it been such a good time to be born as a woman. You just think there's never have women had the safety, the opportunities, the life choices that they do now. Obviously, there are countries like the Middle East where that's maybe not so much the case, but certainly in this country. So if you, in terms of counting your blessings, I mean, that's incredible. And secondly, for all of its the drawbacks involved, we have access, whether monastics, lay people, laymen and laywomen, to a huge amount of the high quality Dhamma teachings through YouTube, for instance. There are books and movies and videos and YouTube, and so I mean this would be unthinkable even, you know, 50 years, 100 years ago. I mean, one of the stories that some of you may be familiar with, the life story of Ajahn Chah, who became a monk in his local village monastery as a young man and became frustrated with life in the village monastery and decided to leave and to search for a meditation teacher take on the life of a forest monk. But where to go? I mean, it's just very hard to find out any information where these teachers are in those days. You know, where do you go for that kind of information in the 1920s in Thailand? So he heard on the grapevine about a monk in Lopburi. And so he and a friend walked all the way from northeast Thailand through all these malarial jungles and through, you know, all the way to Lopburi, which is what, maybe 500-700 kilometers. And he got there and it turned out the teacher had already died. Yeah. So this would be kind of normal in those days, you know. But what's even more amazing is that about 5 kilometers away from the village monastery, that last rains retreat he spent before he left to go out onto the road, one of the monks who was staying in that monastery was Lumphuphan. Lumphuphan, one of the great Arahant disciples of Ajahn Mun, was like three or four miles down the road. And he didn't know, and he walked 400 miles to... this is kind of absolutely normal in the old days. And now, you know, as a laywoman, you can Google, you can YouTube, you can choose from a list of enlightened monks and nuns and listen to teachings that are of personal relevance to you. I mean, this has never been possible in the whole history of Buddhism. So in terms of, you know, being able to go to a monastery every day and having a teacher, you can go and see and just... Yeah, I mean, there's never really been that much opportunity in the past. I think we're quite fortunate, actually, there, even here in Los Angeles. Yeah. Mm.